and welcome everyone to the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell, and this is episode 41. Today, we are joined by Dr. Keith Cantu. Keith is currently a visiting assistant professor at St. Lawrence University in New York, and he will begin soon, next June, as a research affiliate at the Center for the Study of World Religions at Harvard Divinity School, which I happen to know personally very well, CSWR, where Keith will begin a full-time postdoctoral fellowship in Asian religious traditions as part of the Transcendence and Transformation Initiative. So, Keith, welcome back to Yogic Studies, and it's really great to have you here again for this conversation.
Thanks, Seth. Thanks for having me, and again for having me teach on Yogic Studies. And just to correct, I'm already actually affiliated with the CSWR. So, but it's a part-time affiliation that I'm doing remotely, and then I'll join full-time in June.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Well, congratulations on that position. That's really exciting and fun to picture you living in Cambridge and at Harvard at my old stomping grounds there at the CSWR. You came to visit me actually when I was a grad student there.
So, yeah, that's a great memory.
Yeah, that's so. Tell me a little bit more, and listeners, about that position and that project, Transcendence and Transformation, there at Harvard.
Yeah, so that's an initiative to really foreground religious experience and also kind of rehabilitate terms like mysticism that kind of have been, for lack of a better word, poo-pooed in a lot of areas of academia. And so currently the section within that project, the Transcendence and Transformation, which is headed by Charlie Stang there, that is a database. So I was hired to work with one other South Asianist, Aaron Ulrey, on a database for Transcendence and Transformation, which is going to sort of catalog different religious experiences and also have an encyclopedia that can be searchable and available to the public online. And so Matt Dillon is there now. He's the lead on this database, and they're going to host it on the Harvard servers. And we're kind of putting in the yoga and tantra material, and we'll be soliciting lots of feedback and articles from, you know, both junior and senior scholars. You'll probably get one, Seth, too. So we'll be asking you for help, basically.
All right.
Putting this database all together, yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, that sounds great. And right now, you're currently a visiting assistant professor at St. Lawrence University. I just learned that's in upstate New York, up near the border with the U.S. and Canada. And how are things going over there? Are you teaching any courses this semester?
Yeah, it's great. You know, this is my first time really teaching full time. And so they gave me a 3-3 load. And so this semester, I'm teaching three courses, one on yoga transformations, another on religions in South Asia, and another in basically religious studies. It's called Mystery and Meaning, about the theory and construction of the field of religious studies. So that's been really a trip, but I love the students here, and I've been learning so much and growing from them and kind of, you know, seeing where their interests are, you know, the Generation Z, how that all plays into everything. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, that's a full teaching load, but sounds like great courses and all right up your alley, things that you have been thinking about and working on for so many years. So having finished the PhD, I'm sure it's really gratifying to get to teach and work with, is it mostly undergrads there?
Yeah, it's they only have a really small graduate program in education, so it's almost entirely an undergraduate institution. And so the class sizes are really small, so you get to really connect and have discussions that you wouldn't be able to have, you know, at a large state university. So, you know, maybe it's similar to Harvard in that way in terms of the class size. So it's been really great to have those connections and teach and learn. Yeah.
Great. So Keith, you were on the Yogic Studies podcast back in December 2021. I had to go look this up, episode 28, when you came on, when you were teaching a course for us on yoga and esotericism, which was a really wonderful course, great group of students. And it went so well, we had to invite you to come back to teach another course for us, which we'll be talking about here today. But I wanted to mention, you know, in that episode, episode 28, we go into much more detail about Keith's background, his story, how he got into academia and studying these traditions. But maybe just for listeners today, maybe you could just give us like a, you know, a quick background, tell us a little bit about what you do and kind of your areas of research and teaching.
Yeah, so if I had to categorize or classify my area of teaching and research, I would say I'm a historian of religions, specifically South Asian religions in the early modern to modern period, although I do have some sort of background in the languages of ancient and medieval South Asia as well. I'm really interested in connections between these religions and traditions. Basically, the connections between how they're lived and practiced in South Asia, and also how they're exported and globalized, or in my vocabulary, translocalized into something that can spread around the world. And one node that I recognized as very important to that was what we could think of as Western esotericism or esotericism, as kind of the Western and Eastern is often critiqued, understandably these days. And in modern occultism, which as I started to dive into and explore, I learned very quickly it wasn't something super dark and scary necessarily. I mean, maybe there are those parts there, but for the most part, it really connects with South Asia, yoga, tantra, and a lot of things that I had already been studying. So a lot of my research kind of interrogates those margins, you know, kind of where Indologists don't really go, but then also where scholars of American religions don't really go. Like maybe they've mentioned these things, but they don't really explore, trace them back to South Asia. So that's kind of been most of my method, is tracing back a lot of texts and traditions back to their sources and then interrogating them in the original languages.
And for many years, you've been working on a particular figure and project from South India, the Sri Sabhapati Swami. I understand that you have a book that is set to be released for publication. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm going to pull it up here for those watching on YouTube. Let's see. Can you see that?
Yeah. Thanks for the promotion, Seth. Yeah, so I'm super excited about this book. It's the outgrowth of basically the 5-6 years I worked on my PhD dissertation. And then I reformatted it and added quite a bit of material for the book form in terms of making it a cohesive publication. And this is really the first ever monograph on this yogi, Sri Sabhapati Swami, who prior to this work, people only had really evaluated his works in English with their kind of Sanskritic vocabulary and transliterated terms very archaically. And part of my research was tracing back the works in Tamil. Also, there's some Bengali and Hindi works. There's a non-existent Telugu work. And this book basically traces his system of yoga, which you know well, Seth, from your work on Shiva yoga. I'm very familiar with you know, kind of your groundbreaking explorations into the Shiva Yoga Pradipika and Karnataka and that whole milieu. So this is kind of happening several centuries later, where this kind of Shiva Yoga gets localized in Tamil Nadu. And then members of the Theosophical Society encounter it, these diagrams of the yogic body, these explorations of sort of Shaiva cosmology, yoga cosmology that are really deep. And then you even have figures like Aleister Crowley integrate and incorporate Sri Sabhapati Swami's techniques into magic. So it becomes something, you know, just really global. Yeah.
Like a tree universally spread is the title of the book.
The title, exactly. Which I think it fits, you know, so that title is from Sabapati's own quote to describe the experience of yogic samadhi. But clearly the tree of his writings also is like something very universally spread. So, yeah.
Well, congratulations on the book. That's amazing. I'm always impressed. You know, when you finish the dissertation and then the journey from turning the dissertation into a book is no small feat. And it from the outside feels like you did it impressively swiftly. I'm sure there was an immense amount of labor and challenges to do so, but it looks fantastic. You've got fantastic words of praise from no less than scholars like David Gordon White and Suzanne Newcomb, senior scholars in the fields of yoga studies. And so I couldn't be happier for you, excited to read it. Hopefully the hardcover price is a little bit high, it looks like here at 110, but hopefully we can get it in paperback, as Oxford is usually pretty good about doing, getting a paperback version out. Do you know what the plans are for your book?
Yeah, I would hope for either a paperback and also possibly a South Asian edition. I know Oxford University Press has a press in India as well.
So does it have to sell like a certain number of copies of the hardcover for it to warrant a paperback, or how does that work?
You know, that's a good question that I'm going to write down and ask.
I'm not sure.
Having it as an available book like that would be really great.
Yeah,
for sure. In any case, I mean, it will be sent to all the libraries. You know, it's already kind of disseminating outward to many, many different forums where you should be able to check it out or find a copy, or, you know, even find an affordable e-copy online as well. So,
yeah, fantastic. Well, congratulations again.
Thank you.
And I mean, just to connect it now a little bit to really the main topic for our conversation today and your upcoming course at Yogic Studies, let's get into some of these, you know, currents of occultism, or, you know, what scholars refer to as Western esotericism. Here in particular, we're going to be talking about theosophy and yoga. Certainly all of our listeners know what yoga is. Most of them have probably heard of theosophy, but why don't we get started? You know, tell us a little bit, you know, give us a brief introduction to what is theosophy.
So in terms of the word itself, theosophy has a much richer and wider history in esoteric movements, you know, coming out of Europe, also like kind of connections that some have even traced back to Neoplatonism and certain kind of mystic movements in early modern Europe. But in terms of where this course begins, it's the name of a specific society called the Theosophical Society that adopted this concept of theosophy as sort of the wisdom of the gods, or gods, you know, kind of like philosophies, like the love of wisdom. And it's sort of a play on theology, right, where theosophy can be this notion that there can be a universal brotherhood, you know, of sort of people connecting with each other, you know, regardless of race and gender, but that also can have a mythological parallel in terms of the search for meaning in a wide variety of world religions. And so that's, you know, kind of the official definition. I'm not a member of the Theosophical Society. However, I've studied it for, you know, 5 or 6 years now, and I've met with the president of one of the main surviving branches in Adyar of the Theosophical Society. And to my knowledge, theosophy is really centered on making connections between people to understand sort of hidden, you know, forces of nature that are, you know, often neglected in everyday discourse. So there's a sort of openness to maybe practical components, and that's where yoga really comes in, to sort of understand what is the nature of the soul, what is the spirit, you know, what is the mind, the connection between mind, breath, and body. And so this started to emerge, however, in the 19th century, in this milieu full of spiritualism, mesmerism. I'm not sure if any of you all have, you know, the audience is familiar with these, but these are sort of really important big 19th century movements in North America where people were having seances and, you know, contacting spirits and also exploring different modes of healing, you know, whether through contact or remotely. And theosophy sort of emerged from this milieu and then all of a sudden took a turn towards South Asia and India. So that's really where this course begins is, you know, how did that turn come about and what were the reasons for it?
Yeah. So who were some of the key figures associated with the origins of theosophy and then this kind of search in India?
So the main two figures are Helena Blavatsky, who was born in a Russian aristocratic family in what is today Ukraine. And Helena Blavatsky had some travel. It's sort of hard to trace some of her early travels, but there's some evidence that she encountered this Egyptian Coptic magician during her travels to Cairo named Metamond. And she had also traveled apparently to India as well, and also between France and North America. And she met an American named Henry Olcott, basically in 1874 in Vermont. And Henry Olcott was trained in scientific agriculture, as we'll explore. He was a colonel in the Union, so the North, during the Civil War, and even helped to investigate Abraham Lincoln's assassination. But he was also interested in these spiritual movements, you know, because there were a lot of claims of, you know, people moving tables around and, you know, like the classic kind of like haunted house, you know, Victorian idea of, you know, spirits maybe are between the walls and coming in the mirrors and all of these things and are like, you know, emerging in different places. And so they were investigating these kinds of phenomena. And that's where they met in Vermont. But then they quickly decided that we need to create a society to study these kinds of things and have some sort of metaphysics behind it. So have some kind of theoretical structure to talk about, okay, well, what is a spirit? You know, what happens after death and all of these things. And so they teamed up with some other authors and literary figures and founded the society in 1875 in New York City. And so those are sort of the main figures. You had Emma Hardinge Britton, who was an author at that time, a novelist. I mean, Thomas Edison later became a member, you know, so it was kind of a big deal at that time. Yeah.
Right. And then they travel to India and other parts of Asia in search of spiritual masters and kind of trying to trace some of the sources of the ideas of some of the things that they've been reading and hearing about in these North American milieus, as you're describing. What sort of happens? What happens in India, and how does India become so important within the story of theosophy?
Yeah, so what happens is that in 1978, 3 years after the society is founded, you had this contact being made with Dayananda Saraswati, who was one of the heads of the founding member of the Arya Samaj in India. And at that time, it wasn't necessarily so rigid and hardline as it is now, even though it was very much still formulating these discourses on the Vedas and sort of literal adherence to, you know, certain streams of Hindu reform and the like. And so Helena Blavatsky and Henry Olcott at first thought that, oh, Dayananda Saraswati, he must be this authority on yoga that we should make contact with and go. And so that created this sort of impetus to go to India and try to make these connections with this notion of an Aryan wisdom that was perceived to be lost. And at that time, I mean, I should note the word Aryan, you know, hadn't been appropriated by the Nazis and turned into this racist thing. It was mostly related to the etymology of Arya as noble. And so people were in search of these connections. You know, Max Müller had been in search of connections between, Indo-European languages, you know, Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit. And so they were sort of on the spiritual end of this, looking for these connections between souls and spirits and the Atman and Brahman and so on. And so they get to India and arrive basically in 1879. And at that time, they're lecturing with the Arya Samaj, but then they eventually have a break because they realize, oh, we're actually not seeing eye to eye on a lot of things. And so at that time, you had people join the Theosophical Society who were also involved in Arya Samaj, but then you also had people who were not a member of one or the other and so on. So there was kind of a clean break once they realized that Dayananda Saraswati was really interested in more social and political sides of things, which didn't really align with, I think, the founders' visions. But during that moment, you had a whole bunch of other yogis, a whole bunch of other pundits who kind of entered the scene. Mm. And I remember reading somewhere that Henry Olcott and Helena Blavatsky were kind of like rock stars in India during that time because they were interested in this kind of wisdom that, you know, most of the colonial establishment in India was just like completely uninterested in and kind of saw it as this, you know, just, you know, pejoratively like a native kind of wisdom that, you know, didn't really matter much and was just more harmful than helpful. So, yeah, that's kind of what.
So you mentioned that they went to India for, you know, in search of many things, but one of them was teachings on yoga.
Yeah.
Definitely. I'm curious, you know, what do you think the perception of yoga was at the time? We're talking about the late 1800s, mm-hmm. you know, 19th century. Today, of course, the, you know, public and popular perception of yoga is mostly physical health and fitness, mm-hmm. spirituality, yes, but really primarily postural yoga. At that time, you know, what do you think they conceived yoga as and, you know, what were they looking for in terms of a yoga master in India?
Mm. It's a great question. So this is before Swami Vivekananda comes on the scene, even as well, and kind of changes, you know, certain definitions of modern yoga, you know, brings it more in line with Patanjali. And at this time, there was an interest in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali as they were sort of, you know, they had been translated or they were kind of in the process of kind of being integrated into Theosophical spirituality. But the main interest, to my knowledge, was in really searching for a technique that could facilitate a kind of yogic trance and then lead to what was described in the literature of that time as the projection of an astral double. And so there was this sort of belief in a technique that was linked to mesmerism, and we'll get into that in the course. Carl Beyer has written an article on mesmerism in the Theosophical Society. And there was this kind of notion that there could be a mesmeric trance similar to samadhi. So people were seeing a parallel there with the yogic samadhi and the trance, and that through certain breath control and, you know, concentration, meditation, you could facilitate some sort of astral projection of the double. And so esoteric practitioners interested in theosophy were interested in those kinds of techniques at first. And then later, those techniques kind of became minimized. But that was really what propelled some of the early interest in yoga.
Yeah. Yeah, I was revisiting Mark Singleton's Yoga Body recently.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He writes a little bit about this and kind of, you know, some of the views of yoga during that time and looking at the writings of folks like Blavatsky and Mueller and Vivekananda. And he's written, of course, about this sort of anti-hatha yoga sentiment that some of these figures had, where they viewed, you know, hatha yogis as, you know, gymnasts, or I think he even uses the phrase ignorant sorcerers, I think quoting Blavatsky, and that they did really favor this more philosophical view, which often gets lumped with Patanjali and Sankhya. But what you're describing is of the technique is quite interesting, astral projection is even more specific. I'm going to read this quote from Singleton and tell me what you think about this. He says, Blavatsky's claim in 1881 that neither modern Europe nor America had so much as heard of yoga until the theosophists began to write and speak, while hyperbolic, is not made without reason. So that's Singleton kind of quoting and commenting on Blavatsky, kind of crediting the theosophists for putting yoga on the map globally when they began to write about it. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that, about the impact of, you know, they were seeking and searching for these ideas to kind of confirm in some ways, you know, what they were looking for, but they wrote quite prolifically. So talk a little bit about, you know, the impact of their writing, their publications, and how that might have put yoga, let's say, you know, on the map.
Yeah, no, it's a great question and a great quote. So essentially, most of these early members of the Theosophical Societies, the Theosophical Society, they were mediators in a way. And so it's sort of this period in which the image meets and encounters reality. Since a lot of Europeans, Americans, they had this certain image of the East that was tied with all this kind of, you know, romantic Orientalism and all of these kinds of other distortions, you know, that in a lot of ways was linked to simply the fact that this area of the world, you know, was not so connected as it is today. But that started to change with the, you know, the steamship and people able to go there in person. And so what happened is once the members of the Theosophical Society arrived, they started to encounter pundits on yoga and authors on yoga who could then sort of meet them in terms of their ideas on magnetism, mesmerism, you know, all of these other things like astral projection, you know, and so on, these techniques, and then actually say, well, wait a minute, yoga is actually about this, and look at this book, look at this text, you know, look at this practice that comes from Sanskrit. And so what ended up happening is a lot of these yogic pundits were from South Asia, you know, from different regions of India, different regions of South Asia. And they were meeting with these theosophical founders from Europe and North America. And what ended up happening is the definitions of yoga started to merge together in a way, in a cohesive whole. So you get some flavor of the esoteric and the occult, but you also get the Hatha, you know, at that time it was called the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, you know, now we know Hatha Pradipika. You get translations of the Shiva Samhita, the Garanda Samhita, translations of the Shiva Svarudaya. And so these yogic texts that have a rich history in Sanskrit then start to be played up by the South Asian and Indian pundits who are interested in sort of correcting, but also playing into some of these images of yoga as promoting a kind of trance, if you will. And so Hatha yoga had a bad name among some of the global theosophists, but some of the Indian theosophists that we'll study actually thought Hatha yoga was really great. And so, you know, you had Talapragada Subba Rao, who helped facilitate the establishment of the Theosophical Society in Adyar in 1882, he wrote an essay called, you know, basically the Notes on Hatha Yoga, and, you know, promoting it in a very positive light at a time in which other people were kind of linking it to, yeah, sorcery and black magic and so on. So we'll see both sides of it. Yeah.
And those translations that you mentioned, you know, of the Hatha Pradipika and Shiva Sangita, Garanda Sangita, I mean, those have had a huge impact on the global reception of yoga to this day, right? And in fact, even the selection of those particular texts, I think it's not coincidental that those are the primary kind of canon, if you will, of Hatha yoga texts that one might even go into a bookstore today and find on the shelves, or, you know, do a yoga teacher training and you might study those. Do you think, you know, you know, what do you make of the, you know, the impact of the Theosophists and those publications? And also, so you tell us a little bit more about, you know, we've mentioned the big names of the founding figures, Blavatsky and Olcott and so forth, but you were starting to talk there a little bit more about some of the local Indian pundits and scholars who they were working with. Tell us a little bit more about them, and were they considered members of the Theosophical Society, or were they sort of publishing, you know, on their behalf? Are there gray areas there, or any thoughts about any of that jumbled question I just gave you?
I don't think it's jumbled at all. I mean, it certainly connects like a theosophical entanglement, so to speak. These Indian pundits and writers, most of them did become what is called fellows of the Theosophical Society. So there's evidence that they were kind of inducted or initiated as members, but then they also had their own agendas. Many of them were not content to just, you know, receive theories and doctrines from kind of global theosophical leaders and then just sort of parrot them back or, you know, accept them as they are. And so there's a vibrant discourse that starts to emerge where, you know, one of whom I've mentioned, Subha Rao, actually disagrees very wildly with Helena Blavatsky's conception of the tattvas or faculties and, you know, has a really, you know, kind of vibrant publication exchange that happens on other topics in this periodical called The Theosophist. So there was this periodical, and it's important to mention since that provided a forum for many of these Indian pundits to promote their works, to kind of get exposure to other points of view that were circulating in theosophy. And especially in terms of the Indian theosophists, they were also responding to the growth of 19th century philology during that time. And so you had, you know, Friedrich Max Müller, who I mentioned. You know, he had even met with Henry Olcott. There's a great chapter by Donald Lopez in this book, Imagining the East, that I believe we'll read. I think I prescribed it. It's basically about this meeting and disagreement of the placement of a Buddha statue that Max Müller liked to keep on a certain mantle. And he was like, if I want to keep it on this mantle, then I'll keep it there. And Henry Olcott was like, well, that's not kind of the original, you know, context of where a Buddha statue would be. And there's this whole debate that's emerging. My point is with that, there's this whole debate that's emerging over sort of traditionalist interpretations of religion versus the writings in philology that are sort of, you know, trying to also express kind of human systems of knowledge and their interconnections, right, in an academic frame. And so the Theosophical Society is kind of in between there. And the Indian Theosophists are even more in between. And they're feeling compelled that, okay, if we want to bring yoga to the forefront of this discussion, then we have to put out texts on yoga. We have to publish books on yoga. We have to talk about yoga. And so, you know, I think some of the selection of these texts was arbitrary. You know, you've written about this in your dissertation, how kind of that selection has obscured other texts like the Shiva Yoga Pradipika, right? At the same time, these were the texts that were kind of at their disposal that they were interested in editing and using and bringing to a wider audience. So I think, you know, that was a very entangled answer to your entangled question, but it's all connected there. And in terms of the last, I should respond, we'll be studying also some figures who were not members of the Theosophical Society. So Sabhapati Swami, who we talked about, the subject of my book and his yoga, he was never a member of the Theosophical Society, although he encouraged people to join. So there were sort of theosophy adjacent groups, if you will, and figures who sort of aligned with theosophy, but they also, you know, were doing something, you know, on their own terms. And the Theosophical Society kind of opened the doors to be able to do that within the colonial discourse of print culture. Yogis were already doing this in, you know, terms of their ashrams and akras and networks of, you know, texts and manuscript transmission and all of these things. That was already happening. But Theosophy opened the door to do that, I think, within print culture. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. You mentioned Adyar and that you've had an opportunity to go there. I've been there as well. It's a joy for many researchers who work, you know, in this area, because today it's one of the main manuscript libraries and research centers in South India. They have many Sanskrit manuscripts on yoga. In fact, they held several copies of the Shiva Yoga Pradipika. And so when I did my first round of field work, that was one of the sites that I got to go. And you definitely feel like you're a part of this history that you're describing when you go visit there. And you also sense that there is a sort of living tradition of Theosophy that's very grounded in India and Indian culture. So tell me a little bit about that, how Theosophy in India has taken off, and you know, what that looks like today at places like the Adyar Center.
Yeah, so as you've been there, you can appreciate that when you're kind of pulling up or, you know, asking for directions, sometimes it's sort of hard to find, right? In terms of, you know, how do you get there once you're on the ground in Chennai? And living in Adyar for a time, even though I wasn't living on the grounds of the Theosophical Society, I lived in the town of Adyar in that section of Chennai. And whenever I wanted to go, I would say, take me to the society. And they just knew it was the society that was there. And so, you know, I would get to the society, and after spending some time there, I realized that there were these sort of two divisions. There was the Adyar Library and Research Center, and then there were also sort of the buildings that comprised the headquarters of the Theosophical Society with certain traditional buildings. And now they've kind of merged them, and they have, you know, many, many holdings on manuscripts, also printed materials that are very rare, including some books on Sabhapati Swami that I was able to access that were very helpful.
I think it was Jason Birch actually, and his research assistant. They found there was a printed edition in Sanskrit of the Shiva Yoga Pradipika. It belonged to the personal collection of Colonel Henry Olcott. It's inscribed to him on the cover. And that was really useful in my study. So another, you know, when you talk about rare editions, that was a great example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, but I cut you off.
No, I mean, not at all. It's very relevant. It's sort of like a time capsule in many ways that has preserved a lot of these printed materials. At the same time, I think even though Theosophy's influence and reach since the 19th, early 20th centuries has kind of declined, it maintains an important position and presence in modern India, since later members like Annie Besant, you know, helped in the fight for Indian independence. So they were sort of involved in sort of that struggle, and I think there's a recognition that even though, you know, the society is kind of foreign somehow by nature, it just sort of arrived there, that it sort of has assimilated to, you know, Indian culture and ways of being. And, you know, most of the people who work at the society who are employed there at the library and on the grounds, they're all, you know, from South Asia, especially Tamil Nadu. So you get the sense that you're sort of in this Indian-run Theosophical Society, which possibly had been the case at, you know, even at the earlier time. It's just we kind of think that, you know, immediately when we think Theosophy, we think of it as some, you know, some global movement that's coming from outside. But really, the day-to-day workings of the society, I think, you know, from relatively early, if not the beginning, were pretty pretty solidly South Asian-run and operated. So, yeah.
And I know, like, since the passing of Blavatsky and Olcott, the Theosophical Society has kind of split in, like, different ways, as I understand it. So there's sort of different movements or schools associated with Theosophy. Can you say anything about Jiddu Krishnamurti, who, you know, listeners might know a little bit about and was very popular, especially in the 70s, and was kind of the anti-guru, if you will,
yeah.
Who charismatically in front of large audiences told people that they didn't need a guru, but he also wrote prolifically, but he had a very, as I understand it, a unique association with the Theosophical Society. And also, I mean, he had a lot to say, I think, on yoga as well, product of that time, but.
Yeah, so with Krishnamurti, you know, he was heralded as this world teacher. I think he was discovered on a beach in Besant Nagar, not far from Adyar, and eventually was heralded as this world teacher by the post Blavatsky and Olcott members of the Theosophical Society. And then what happened is, as you know, he sort of became the anti-guru. He rejected that role. He's like, hey, I'm actually not the world teacher, guys, but I have a lot of wisdom still, and that's okay. And so, you know, which to be fair, he comes across as very erudite and wise and understanding of sort of a wide range of topics related to yoga and spirituality. And I've been to his house in Ojai. And seen his library, and I talked to someone there who was also his personal chef, and he said he really liked the pasta dishes the best. You know, he would make him the spaghetti and he would eat there and everything. And I mean, it's a really quiet and tranquil area, and the impression that I got from encountering and reading works by Krishnamurti, even though I'm not a specialist, I haven't done as much research in Krishnamurti as I probably should. The impression that I got is that he was trying to basically promote a system of yoga and spirituality that could be compatible, or that could maybe have come out of theosophy, but was not limited to any kind of theosophical discourse. And I think in that sense, it's sort of like some of these yoga texts, right? They were like born out of theosophy, but their reach has far expanded even the limits of the Theosophical Society itself. And in many ways, I think that was kind of the point. I don't think the founders of the Theosophical Society really ever wanted to have, you know, control over the whole narrative of yoga. I mean, I don't think there might be certain figures who promoted this view that they have some kind of authentic understanding that other people don't. But for the most part, especially from the perspective of these Indian theosophists, they were interested in publishing books and having their reach spread out across pan-India. First of all, so pan-South Asia, readers, basically educated Indians all across South Asia in terms of, you know, who could read English, in that sense of literacy, and also expand these works to a whole wide audience of interested parties in Europe and North America. So these books traveled outward, right? And I think Krishnamurti is kind of the same way. Even though he came out of theosophy and he kind of rejected that role, he sort of expanded beyond that. And I'm not sure how his teachings on yoga reflect or don't reflect these earlier texts, but my hunch is that they are coming from sort of a much more contemporary lens than these kind of early 20th century works. Yeah.
So let's look a little bit now at the course itself, sure. YS126, Theosophy and Yoga. It's going to run live at Yogic Studies on October 23rd through November 17th, 2023. Of course, if you're listening to this after that, everything's been recorded and you can jump in anytime and take the course at your own pace. Tell us, Keith, a little bit about this image that we're looking at that is sort of the featured image of the course. We've got a lot of figures here gathered for this sort of official photograph in India.
Yeah, so you can see Helena Blavatsky and Henry Olcott in the center there. And next to Henry Olcott, you have also Franz Hartmann, who was a German theosophist, and his friend Damodar Mavalankar right next to him. They're close by. Maybe they're like you know, having some sort of, you know, esoteric conversation. And then you also have, I highlighted them in my screenshot, so don't worry. He's like in the front row, fourth from the right. Okay. Is Tukaram Tatya, a little bit further to the right there. Tukaram Tatya, right next to him, so in the back. Yeah, right there. I believe so. Yeah, that's Tukaram Tatya. And he helped put out one of the most important translations of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. At that time, they were called the Aphorisms of Patanjali. And Henry Olcott contributed an introduction. And so basically, these are yoga pundits, teachers, you know, literati who were engaged in theosophy in some way, and they were in support of the ideals, even if they didn't align fully with everything that the theosophists were saying. They had gathered together to celebrate the founding of the Theosophical Society headquarters in Adyar. So this was, I think, taken in 1882 or 83, depending on which caption we believe. But this was basically right when the Theosophical Society had been established in Adyar. And that building is still around, sort of right adjacent to the river. So you have sort of many names who became important later on.
And this photo is also taken, I believe, is your photograph taken at, is this at Adyar as well?
Correct. Yeah. So it's just a beautiful green space in the middle of this sort of sprawling geography. And I think that also deserves some credit, which is sort of the connection between all this and the environment. There was sort of this also push for a sustainable sort of grounds with which people could have this space for contemplation and calm. So you'll see there's like lotus ponds, there's, you know, a giant bunion tree, you know, all these kinds of things there. And you know, from having walked around the grounds, it's sort of like, where am I? Am I in Chennai still? You know, when you walk through these
yeah, it's a little oasis. Sort
of portal. Yeah.
All right. So tell us a little bit about what students can expect, the four modules that they will be exposed to. If you're watching again on YouTube, we have it here, but I'll have Keith kind of guide us, give us a little bit of a preview of each of these four modules.
For sure. So in the first module, we will tackle a lot of what I had sort of introduced when you asked the question about kind of, you know, how did theosophy begin? What is it? We'll talk about the founding of the society and go much more in depth in terms of how they encountered and engaged with teachings and authorities on yoga, how they were kind of responding to the philology focused impetus to publish texts during the late 19th century, which led to wonderful series like the Sacred Books of the East, for example, and opened doors for people who wanted to kind of practice some of these Eastern teachings as foreigners, right? And so theosophy's, you know, kind of role in mediating that will be kind of the most important part of this module, as well as we'll talk about Tukaram Tatya and sort of the ways in which Indian theosophists helped sponsor some of these theosophical works and were really behind some of these translations and kind of introduce that phenomenon kind of through their patronage, if you will. And then we'll also look at the kind of mesmeric and astral trance that these earlier theosophists had viewed yoga and samadhi as. So, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and then module two, we'll look at two of the most important examples and most prolific examples of Indian theosophists who had written on yoga. So one of them is Srish Chandra Bosu, or sometimes his pen name is S.C. Vasu, as well as Ramaprasad Keshap. And they both went to the same college, Government College Lahore, and were there when Helena Blavatsky and Henry Olcott had visited. They did join the Theosophical Society and were interested in publishing books on yoga and correlating some of these ideas on yoga with esoteric and occult ideas. So you see in the case of Ramaprasad, he's actually reformulating this work called the Shiva Svarudaya, portions of which date to the 12th century, as this occult science of breath or nature's finer forces. And he doesn't mention the title in that book, but it's sort of this mysterious Shivagama, you know, this Agama of Shiva, this text, you know, this sort of tantric text on Shiva. We look at sort of how those teachings became instrumental on sort of occult understandings of the tattvas. So there were these shapes that were depicted in this text, and these shapes were used later on for divination as well as a kind of yoga. And with Sri Chandra Bosu, we will look at his complicated, you brought up the complicated relationship with Hatha Yoga that Mark Singleton had also brought up in his book. I think with figures like Sri Chandra Bosu, it's really complicated because on the one hand, he's seeing certain strands of Hatha Yoga as sort of a lower form of Tantra or sorcery, what have you. But then on the other hand, he's, you know, growing up around, you know, Anath pundit named Shivnath, who lived near his house. He's an editor for Sri Sabhapati Swami's book on yoga, which is kind of a tantric yoga that also talks about Hatha yoga a little bit. And he's also editing texts like Shiva Samhita and Garanda Samhita that are like, you know, pretty important texts on Hatha yoga, while at the same time having reserved views. And so we'll look at kind of the complicated, relationship that some of these pundits had towards yoga, like Sri Chandra Bosu and Rama Prasad. And then lastly, we'll look at their sort of counterpoint to Max Müller's Sacred Books of the East was their Sacred Books of the Hindus series. Mm. And what's interesting in this series is that you have these books on yoga, but in the Sacred Books of the Hindus series, you have verses in the Shiva Samhita that are sort of taken out or extracted as perhaps being too controversial. Whereas in the earlier editions of the Shiva Samhita, you do have these verses in fully. So there were these sort of attempts to, you know, I guess kind of control and regulate what teachings on yoga were sort of transmitted to global audiences, if you will.
Yeah, so, if I remember correctly, I think in Vasu's Hatha Pradipika, he omits some of the verses on Vajroli Mudra. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the Shiva Samhita.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So yeah, that's what you're referring to. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, he omitted it in the Sacred Books of the Hindus version, but in the original version, they're all there. The verses are there.
Mm. So it was for a different audience, perhaps.
Exactly. Or someone came around and was like, you know, you shouldn't expose these kinds of controversial techniques, you know, to a prudish colonial, you know, audience, you know, who are going to be relatively prudish and might ban the book or might, you know, attract some sort of, moratorium on the publication. Because, I mean, some of these books were limited to how they would be registered by the civil authorities. And, you know, I've visited the Tamil Nadu archives, which was basically the Madras Record Office during the colonial period. And they had to approve books. They basically had to stamp this book as being legitimate or able to be printed. And so I think maybe a lot of yogic books that may have been written were not written, you know, since there's no way that they would have been stamped for approval by the Madras Record Office. So
yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, speaking of Madras, so the earlier name of Chennai, here we have the Madras yogi, Sabhapati Swami, and his teachings on what he called divine pilgrimage as expressed in diagrammatic form. And we'll talk about how he specifically had a diagram that Henry Olcott commented on as being related to the astral body and the astral double, and how essentially Henry Olcott and Helena Blavatsky had met him, but couldn't believe that he had physically flown to Mount Kailasa to commune with Shiva. And so that's, an interesting story. You know, there were probably a lot of other things going on But nevertheless, Sri Sabhapati Swami still encourages people to join the Theosophical Society, and his works reflect especially this theosophical preoccupation with mesmerism, not in terms of the practices, but in terms of how Indic practices are framed. And so, for instance, if you look at his English works, you'll see that there's this diagram that we'll look at that is called like blessing diksha or mesmerism. And it's about basically guru diksha, sort of like giving initiation through touch or contact, what's really popularly known as shaktipat or shaktipata today. And if you look then at the same diagram in the Tamil and in the Hindi, you don't see mesmerism at all. It's only in the English. It's just a straight up, this is the diagram on diksha. And so you see how sort of these theosophical understandings of mesmerism were sort of mapped over a traditionally Indic practice. So that's what we'll look at.
Yeah. All right. And then the fourth and final module.
Yeah. So the fourth one, we will look at some more recent material that I've been looking at on Talapragada Subba Roe. And I mentioned before, he was instrumental in bringing the Theosophists to Adyar and establishing the headquarters there. And he led a relatively short life, but was one of the most open out of the South Asian authors on yoga to incorporating a theosophical vocabulary on Egypt, Greece, and sort of these hermetic understandings. He was also kind of critiquing certain strands of Christian mysticism and comparing it to Vedanta, comparing it to Hatha yoga and all of these other sort of techniques related to yoga. And so we'll look at Subba Rao's writings, so-called esoteric writings that survive, and especially under this his pen name, Solar Sphinx, and talk about sort of his view on Hatha yoga and how that compared to some of the, you know, more problematizing views of the other Indian theosophists. So it kind of gives you a range, right? That there was no single or, you know, singular perspective on some of these yogis that the Theosophical Society had sort of generated. It was much more multipolar, depending on which writer, depending on whether they were Indian theosophists or global. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, this is an incredibly rich sequence of modules and survey that you've laid out for us here. Really unique and groundbreaking research that you've been doing. And I think students are going to get a great overview of these topics and, you know, immersion into the history of theosophy, but then also so much more. As I'm listening to you, I can't help but think, you know, how rich this sort of conversation is in lieu of today's kind of conversations around yoga and cultural appropriation, yeah. As if this is a new conversation, this idea of, you know, mixing and synthesizing and appropriating or utilizing across cultures, with yoga being central to that, these dialogues and intercultural flows have been happening for so long. And what I think this work really highlights is how it really, these cultural borrowings are really flowing both ways. You really have, you know, these Western American and European thinkers and writers who are going to India and adopting certain ideas and bridging them with their own vocabulary and spiritual leanings. But then you also really have these Indian pundits and scholars like Subba Rao here, who is really kind of going the other way as well.
Yeah.
Any thoughts about how this discourse kind of can shine light on the topic of cultural appropriation in yoga today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the emphasis that I have found in terms of studying these materials in their original languages and also sort of how this connects to the global theosophical discourse is that it's important to attribute agency to an author. Whether or not we believe that, you know, their borrowings may be authentic or inauthentic, or they might be sort of enmeshed in this web of, you know, cultural power dynamics and, you know, the flow of information, it's still important to see agency, I think, where agency is. And so my impetus has been to look at some of these South Asian authors as trying to operate within this web of information in which occultism and esotericism actually offered a path for their ideas and for their language to be understood. Now, that's not to say that that was the only path, but it did open up a certain discourse for their ideas to be understood and to have agency. And the people who were really paving that path, when you look at the sources, were not so much the you know, quote unquote, Western theosophists. I mean, they had certain ideas on yoga that they would put out in sort of the broad periodicals. But if you go back through the theosophist and look at sort of who's writing and who are the sources for many of these ideas on yoga, I mean, these are South Asian authors to begin with. So, you know, who's to say where the appropriation starts and where it ends? I think that it's better to see things in terms of local and translocal or global or transcultural at that level, and then also see that there was a pan-Indian, pan-South Asian level that was also happening with interactions between regional traditions of yoga. And that's really what I argue in my book with Sabapati Swami, is that this local and translocal flow becomes a little more nuanced when dealing with something so vast and entangled. Yeah.
Yeah, well said. So the course begins on October 23rd. We hope you'll consider joining us to continue this conversation, to really dive much deeper into the topics that we've just scratched the surface on here in this conversation today. So thank you so much, Keith, for your time and for joining us at Yogic Studies again. We're really excited to have you offer this course.
Thank you, Seth, and thanks for having me again. And to you all who are listening or watching, I hope to see you in the course.
All right. Take care, everyone. Until next time.